but it worked. What a miracle.
So far, so good.
So good. First of all, thank you both a million for being willing to do this. What a I'm so grateful for both of your times. And before we get started, I just want to ask up front if it's okay if I record our phone conversation as we discuss today.
Yes. Totally fine.
Perfect. Lovely. Well, it's funny. I kind of know of you both randomly, Amy, because we rode the bus together at Midwest, and Andrea, because I've had friends go to Michigan, and then a good buddy of mine, Will Lake, graduated from Maryland, did his undergrad and master's there.
Yeah.
And we were just chatting a while back, and he was like, no way you're interviewing her. I said, yeah. And he said, aww. Oh, my God, she's at Maryland. I'm so excited about that. So he sends his regards as well.
We met when you came to Michigan,
we did,
right?
Meet when I came to Michigan. Yes, I came for came for an away game when I was at
Indiana.
Yeah, and I think maybe your first year there? I think that was, or maybe not your first. It would have been in like 2000, I don't know, 11, 12?
No, I wasn't there yet.
No, never mind.
It would have had to been after 20.
It would have been, it would have been 13 or 14. Sorry. I think it would have been.
It was early, very early.
Got it. Great. Yeah, that's right. I didn't start my master's at IU until that fall of 12. So it would have been 14 graduation. So in any case, thank you both for doing this. I'm looking forward to it. This idea came about through actually at Murray State, the eighth floor of our College of Fine Arts is the WKMS radio station and a TV station. And the director of the radio station asked if I would be interested, since I was a new faculty member, in trying to help him come up with an idea for a new content. And so I said, well, I've had this idea about band music for a while that seems to be getting a little bit of traction in other places. What do you think about it? And actually, you probably know, Andrea, being from the Atlanta area, Scott. Why did I just lose his last name?
Scott
Stewart. Yeah, he's an IU grad.
Mm-hmm.
And so I had met him at IU events and summer music clinic stuff. And so we chatted a little bit about the project, and he gave some insight to it. And so I kind of thought, well, since we have all this conversation going on right now in our profession about various number of topics, this might be a fun way to tackle some of them. So that's sort of
that's amazing.
The genesis of the idea. And I'm meeting with Gary Gilroy next week, actually, to talk about like the possibility of do I think this could be any sort of print thing? But I think that's not really what, and I don't know. We'll see how that conversation goes. In any case, I'm excited about the podcast here. So I thought we would just jump in. Could you both maybe intro yourself, maybe 1 or 2 minutes, just give us, the listener, a background to how you are, how you came to where you are now?
Sure.
We can just alternate going first. It doesn't matter. Whoever would like to jump in first.
Okay. I'll jump in.
Super.
Well, again, my name is Dr. Amy Knopf. I am the Associate Director of Bands and Director of Athletic Bands at the University of Missouri. I teach in the School of Music, and my responsibilities in the School of Music are to direct our second of 3 concert bands called Symphonic Band, both in the fall and the winter semester. I also have the great privilege of directing Marching Mizzou, our marching band at the university, in addition to Mini Mizzou, our pep band structure at the University of Missouri. And I teach courses in our music education curriculum, advanced conducting course, rehearsal clinic, marching band techniques of those nature. And I came into my position in the summer of 2017. Prior to that, I served for 7 years in a similar position at Eastern Michigan University in Ypsilanti, Michigan. Prior to that, I was at the University of Georgia working on my DMA with one of my main conducting teachers, Dr. John Lynch. And prior to that, I was at the University of Kansas with Dr. Lynch, receiving my master's degree. And before going to the University of Kansas, I was in the Kansas City area at Center High School and Center Middle School. I taught 7th through 12th grade. in the public schools, and that obviously middle school, and then also the high, all the whole round, the high school marching band, the winter drum line, winter guard, all of it there at that high school level.
Cool.
And yeah, and I received my undergraduate degree at the University of Missouri back in 2001. So I'm one of those that have circled back home and is working and serving my home institution, which is a deep honor and a privilege.
Cool. How fun.
Yeah.
That's awesome to come back.
It is. It's very humbling, and it's wonderful.
It's awesome. And Andrea, you want to tell us a little bit about yourself as well?
Sure. My name is Dr. Andrea Brown. I am brand new this year as the Associate Director of Bands at the University of Maryland, where I work with our second ensemble called the Wind Ensemble, and then I oversee all of our athletic bands, and then future things to be determined as I'm new in the position.
Certainly.
Previously, I was at the University of Michigan for 5 years, where I was assistant director of bands. Before that, I was at Georgia Tech in Atlanta, where I was the director of orchestras and then assistant director of bands, and got involved with some research endeavor that continues to this day with a virtual conducting system to help with the training of beginning conductors. Prior to that, I did my doctorate at the University of North Carolina at Greensboro, did some teaching at my alma mater, which is Austin Peay State University, the rival to Murray State, in the Ohio Valley Conference.
Down the road school. We won't talk about that.
Yes. Yes. Let's go, Peay. But I did my undergrad there, and then I taught there as an assistant director of bands. That was my first college position. I did a master's in horn performance and music education at the University of North Carolina, Greensboro, kind of in the midst of all of that. My kind of those master's and doctorate periods were separated. And then I taught public school, taught middle school in Milwaukee and high school in the Dallas area. And I think that kind of takes care of the bulk of it.
That's great. And that was one of the things that I was most excited about as I was reading through both of your bios when you both agreed, is that what diverse experience you both have. You've taught in the public schools. You've been through different collegiate positions, and whether you're returning back home or you've been, you know, I know of the Austin Peay program. Just, again, I'm like you, Andrea, I'm in my first year, like, which way is up? I know of Austin.
I'm in my second year and I feel that way sometimes.
Yeah. I know of Austin Peay, and John Fannin, who's here, speaks very highly of the marching band director there. And while I've not met them, I have heard of the program. So it's great to hear from you both about all of that. I thought we could jump right in with your varied backgrounds. And I think just now, Amy, maybe you can talk about this too, returning back to your alma mater, and Andrew, your experience at maybe UNCG, I know with John Locke's retirement, he's been there quite some time. So maybe how does that inform our first question here, which is, do you think that band conductors from the early 20th century would recognize our ensembles today? And is that a good or bad thing? And maybe, Andrew, we'll start with you since Amy jumped in first last time.
Well, when I read when you sent these questions, that was a very interesting one. I would say barely.
Sure.
But I think that's a really good thing. I mean, there's some obvious things that are, I think which would, you know, just were kind of baked into the system. Then the fact that they're just more diverse.
Sure.
And that the instrumentation is more fluid and constantly changing. And so I would say that those are, you know, and that, How dare you that you might have non-males and people of color in front of and involved in them, I think are, you know, huge differences from that. And so, you know, like I said, I would wrap it up to say barely, but I think it's a very good thing.
Yeah, it's great. Amy?
Yeah, I think at the, you know, kind of the skeleton, you know, at the core, I think, you know, they would recognize it, but I'm hopeful that they would champion the extended range of percussion sounds that are now available to us. And especially as we are working to weave in pieces with electronics or multimedia as well. And I'm hopeful that they would view that probably as an initial shock, but that eventually it would be a good thing for us because we're pushing the medium of our ensemble and really working to incorporate the capabilities of our ensemble here.
Yes.
At the current rate and then what we're doing in the future.
Sure, absolutely. Andrew, I know that Mike Voda, who conducts the Wind Orchestra, is that the correct name of that top
mm-hmm.
ensemble?
Yep.
So it's interesting to hear, I was just talking to someone the other day about what's in a name when we talk about ensembles. And it's interesting to hear mm-hmm. that the order of groups at your school is the same as the two groups at Eastman, right? I mean, he's an Eastman student there, right? With the Wind Orchestra
yes.
being the second group and the Wind Ensemble being the top group. Is that opposite? Certainly of what your setup
yeah,
is?
Yeah, that's opposite here.
Got it. Okay. Interesting. And now, do you think, speaking now with the second bands, and I know both of you conduct the second group at your university, how do you think that group particularly looks different than maybe what your teachers even saw when they were in college? I mean, I know the old model is the symphony band where there was just this massive group. How do you feel that the second group at institutions sort of serves differently or doesn't serve differently in this capacity of where it may have at the beginning of, you know, the early 1900s.
Maybe you want to take that one first?
Sure. Well, first, you know, at the University of Missouri, you know, our top group is the Wind Ensemble. And
sure.
my colleague, our director of band, Dr. Brian Silvey, he is truly one on a part personnel, and that kind of fluctuates a little bit. You know, the top group, they may have a little bit of doubling here and there. And so that's in place, certainly for us. And then in my group, the symphonic band, you know, we do have a little bit larger ensemble, but it's still in some cases, you know, very minor doubling. It's still kind of like the secondary wind ensemble almost. And then
sure.
our third ensemble, university band, is more that large, you know, symphony band model. And that's, you know, part because of, you know, the scholarship tie, you know, the
sure.
major tie that we have, of course, to our ensembles and, you know, what we want to service and how we want to service our students. So we've kind of built it that way as, you know, my group, you know, you're training to be, you know, in the wind ensemble and to have that top wind ensemble experience.
Sure.
Yeah, I would say that's similar here. The probably even to a little bit more extreme than the situation at Missouri. It's not only one on a part with the wind orchestra, but most of the music is not of traditional orchestration or
mm-hmm.
instrumentation.
Right.
And so it's more larger, I'll say larger, but not large chamber ensembles, you know, groups that
certainly.
Require a conductor, but smaller than a one on a part wind ensemble.
Got it.
And so here, the wind ensemble, the second group, I think serves as a place where the students can have more experience with some of that top level, I say traditional, but just more traditional than what the wind orchestra plays, music and repertoire for even on one on a part. You know, we have the capabilities of moving in between one on a part or doubling some things depending on the rep that we're playing, but being exposing the students to that more of the canon and others in the literature where that's not really the experience that they're getting in wind orchestra.
Certainly. Certainly. Great. While we're talking about repertoire,
the second question on here, and it's interesting. Everyone's answer to this tends to be the same, but for multiple reasons. So I'm excited to hear from both of you. The question is, how important is selecting meaningful repertoire?
It's critical.
Yeah.
We need a digital passing stick, right? So whoever's holding the stick gets to go first.
I think it's extremely critical. It's just Amy said. I think you're especially with the situations that we're in, you know, with these, we're tending to get the younger players, and so that's also, you know, training them for moving to another ensemble. You're looking at, you know, music that's going to help them develop as musicians. You're also, as individual musicians, you're also thinking about, you know, how those pieces will work for us developing as an ensemble and developing those skills. You also want to think about, you know, cultivating or curating a wonderful experience for the audience. And then as well, you know, making those choices of you know, the very important choices of who the composers are that you're that are represented in your repertoire.
Sure. Amy, do you want to elaborate on your sentence? It's everything.
It is critical. Yeah, and you know, there's that great article that H. Robert Reynolds had composed, you know, that repertoire equals curriculum. And that is simply it. You know, for me personally, as I'm approaching, you know, repertoire programming, first of all, everything that Andrea said, you know, but it has to work. You know, I look for pieces that have the quality craftsmanship to it, that are going to expose our students to the main elements of music, that's going to push them artistically, that's diverse and a good piece for them to be exposed to and connect to. And it has to have that educational value to it, you know, because that is our, you know, mission as educators. It has to, you know, fit within our overall curriculum and vision of the ensemble, but it does have to push them artistically. And that's at the heart of what we're doing. We're creating, you know, as musicians as conductors, and it has to enhance the expression of the human condition. We've got to be able to tie to it. And furthermore, it simply has to work. You know, students can smell it a mile away. If a piece doesn't work, or if it's not compatible to ensemble, or if for some reason as a connector we are disconnected to it in some way, then they immediately disconnect to it. So we have to connect. We have to be passionate about it. And again, as Andrea mentioned, it has to be a good experience, or maybe just an experience for the audience. We've got to challenge them as well in their listening experience, not only of that piece, but our total program,
right,
whether it's positive or they react to it in a different way. You know, that's our role as artists, you know, and we're the vehicle for the composer's art. We're taking care of their vision of what they have worked on, and we have to do our absolute best as a conductor and as performers representing their vision and providing that and communicating that to the audience. So
yeah, sure.
In totality, we hope it's all meaningful, you know, because we just, again, have to challenge our students, you know, well, what are we saying here? Bottom line with our art. And again, how are we communicating that?
Yeah. How, Andrea, what's your, you conduct the second group. How many concert bands are there at any given time at Maryland?
Three.
Okay.
We have a university band, which is our non-majors.
Sure.
And like secondary instrument kind of things.
And so how
that's kind of your...
Sorry. I was just going to say, I didn't mean to interrupt you. I just was going to ask, and how do you go about, as we're talking about repertoire, you know, selecting meaningful repertoire, what is the process for you all as a band faculty sort of sifting through repertoire to decide kind of where and how things fall, you know, maybe for each group? Is that a sort of a collaborative experience, or do you, how does that work?
Here, it's, I mean, it's developing. You know, there's some things that are changing and developing here because of just a new consideration and eyes and thoughts about moving forward, because personnel sure. and roles were different prior to me getting here.
Yes, they were.
So, yeah. So that's nothing. There was a collaboration in that, you know, Voda sent me what he was planning for this year. And, but for the most part, those are not going to overlap because
right.
of how he tends to, you know, what he tends to program. That's for the most part, not going to be anything that I'm really going to, there's not too much of that that would be necessarily part of what I would program for this group. Now, I'm also brand new, and
right.
so it was a bit of this, you know, this year you're putting some stuff out there that you hope is going to work. You know, you're not exactly sure of what, you know, which is always a bit of that, but even more so this year because of not truly knowing the students. But
I love programming blind. I'm right there with you.
Yes, but my previous institution, you know, a well-established process of oversight
mm-hmm.
From the top for all of the bands, and that even included the non-major bands.
Yeah. It's great. And Amy, for you all as well, you sort of have this, it sounds like similar structure, two ensembles with mostly music majors plus the university band. How do you all approach repertoire, selecting meaningful repertoire?
Well, in some ways it is collaborative, you know, because the top group, of course, they're, you know, programming more of that grade six professional literature, but there are times certainly they have in their program, you know, pieces that I would select for symphonic band. And so we discussed in those terms, you know, what are those pieces that my colleagues thinking about programming. And for me, I'm one of those theme people. I have to have a theme or some kind of overarching connection, not necessarily for every single concert, but in totality, the overall concert series for the entire year. And so my colleagues know that. So when that is set, you know, that kind of typically drives me away from other pieces they may or may not be selecting for their top group. And, you know, that drives that philosophy and those selections. But, you know, we do collaborate, have conversations, you know, about, again, tying back to the curriculum and the vision for our program, you know, bottom line, what are we and how are we servicing our students? And I look at that with my own programs, you know, okay, who's missing here? What voices are the students, compositional voices are the students not hearing in their totality of 4 years?
Sure.
And that drives a lot of my decisions as well as I look ahead to different themes or different, you know, concerts experiences for the students.
Sure, absolutely.
And then as we service our own graduates, students, you know, and their conducting experiences with our top ensembles, what pieces are important for them to conduct that will service not only our undergraduate student population, but also them as developing conductors that will, you know, be wonderful for them to be exposed to in their own development and
yeah.
would be good to put on, of course, a job tape.
Sure, absolutely. We've talked a little bit about, I know, Andrew, you brought up the idea of some of the repertoire that the top group does there being kind of, not, you didn't say radical. I'm just thinking about some of the programming lists I read sometimes in the journal from Professor Voda and some of this music that, and while some of that is certainly canonic, I think you mentioned the word canon earlier, how do you each approach music that might be considered outside the canon, whether that be a new piece by a composer that's in the canon or a new piece by someone who's never written anything that we've considered as canonic? How do you approach that, both programming and conducting that with your ensembles? And is it different than any other music that you do?
Well, I think it's extremely important. You know, for me, when I'm programming, I like to have representation from both sides of that.
Sure.
And then as far as, I mean, I think that's important for both the members of the ensemble and for the the audience. But I don't approach how they're rehearsed or, you know, anything in the rehearsal process. I don't approach that any differently. Like, to me, they're, you know, obviously the students might be more familiar with a well-known name or, you know, a piece in from the canon, but as far as the approach to making sure that all of the performances are of high quality and bringing our very best of that, that doesn't change. It doesn't depend on the piece.
Sure.
Yeah, I definitely agree with that, unless it's completely outside of the box for some reason, just to set up a little bit of the student's ear or experience, so they're coming into it with a little bit more background. I think that would be the only thing that may be different. Yeah, I would agree with that.
Yeah. I'm interested, as we keep talking about, obviously a lot of this is about repertoire, which I know we could probably all go on for days and continue our conversation next week and then get on a plane and arrive in Chicago.
Yes.
And arrive in Chicago and start back up the same conversation. But tell me a little bit about, have you programmed any music recently, or what music have you programmed recently by female composers that you think people should know more about, or pieces that you've found, or pieces you've heard other groups playing, some music that you're interested in?
Amy, you want to go first?
Well, sure. Oh, you know, there's so much attention to this right now, and rightfully so, and well-deserved. Just thinking about, you know, the great female composers that are out there, you know, Christy Custer, Jennifer Jolly, Jody Blackshaw, you know, Joni Green, Shelley Hansen, you know, Julie Giroux. There's wonderful, you know, people out there that, you know, have been well established for quite some time, and that we're continuing to, you know, turn our attention to and champion and, you know, put them on our program and our concerts. And so, yay.
Sure. Yeah.
Like, I think that's kind of the hard thing. And Amy, you might agree with this.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's, you know, like your question, Trey.
Sure.
For me, it's like I don't, it's so, so much a part of everything that I think about all the time that it's, for me,
yeah.
It's like, how mm-hmm. how can somebody not know who these people are?
Oh, I
absolutely.
Hear. Absolutely. we just played a piece by, in the fall, Poem to Few by Ida Gutowski. You know, one of the really early compositions, two movements, sounds kind of like Shostakovich in some places. And I had a number of people come up to me after the concert saying, you know, I don't know that I've ever heard this piece before, one. And two, I didn't know that music written by a female existed, like, prior to yesterday. And I just thought, well, holy cow.
Right.
Holy cow. We have all sorts of work to do here.
Absolutely.
And that's where I just... Sometimes I'm not sure I have a good perspective of what the best way to say this, but, you know, like the average audience member or average, mm-hmm. you know, even ensemble member, because, you know, right now this is not intended to be negative, but it's like we're like hit over the head with it so much now. I just it's hard for me to remember and get the perspective of somebody that's unaware right now.
Right.
Now, mm-hmm. I'm trying to do a better job of that, but that's just where I am in now, my, you know, personal journey at the moment.
Certainly. And now you serve, Andrea, on the CBNA committee for gender and ethnic minorities. Is that correct?
Yes.
Tell me, how long has that committee been in existence? And was this conversation, obviously this conversation was happening within CBNA much earlier than it may surfaced recently and the public face of classical music, but what are some of the goals within that committee that you might be able to share that sort of address this idea of other females or minority composers who, or even conductors, as for all that matter?
Well, the CBDNA committee, I honestly couldn't tell you. I'd have to do some research to find out when it was started.
Sure.
It has been around for a while. And I have to say, like, I have to give a lot of credit to Amy's former colleague at Eastern Michigan, Mary Schneider, who has served multiple tenures with that committee and has just done an immense amount of work to make sure that, because that committee's influence and activity is based on the leadership of CBDNA at the time. And so the one thing that has been consistent from the committee has been this effort to get female and persons of color involved in conducting workshops.
Mm-hmm.
And that's really been the one aspect that has been constant. There have been times when the committee has delved into composers of, again, female or people of color and their interaction with CBDNA, but that has not been as consistent throughout. And so it's, you know, so it's there's the efforts of the committee are not always the same, as it kind of depends on the leadership of CBDNA at the time.
Got it. Certainly.
But I will tell you, like, the group that is currently active in that, on that committee, are looking to continue to expand those efforts and activities.
Absolutely.
I think bottom line, just the opportunities, bringing that representation to the forefront, making sure that we're creating a welcoming environment and bringing more and more people and adding more and more people to our base. So we can feel, I guess, it's hard to say, just bringing everyone into the fold, making sure, again, we're creating opportunities, you know, for everyone to move forward on our mission.
Sure. Absolutely. This is kind of a side rail question, but I was thinking about this in the prep about our conversation and thinking now, As like you were saying, the committee has done quite a bit of work, and that spawned out of the leadership of CBDNA at the time. I can't help but notice there are, with as few female, there are more and more female director of bands at many institutions across the country, and that number is increasing. But can you talk about, both of you are the director of athletic bands at two major athletic universities. I mean, we're talking like big time athletics here. Can you talk about any, you know, that experience maybe? I mean, I've been to a couple of athletic meetings here with John Fannin, our athletic band director. And as I sit in those rooms for like a game day week with basketball, doubleheader, men's and women's, and a football weekend, I can't help but notice that the only woman in the room is the director of athletic bands, or director of athletics secretary, who is mostly there passing out, you know, the schedules and telling everyone else, like, this is the update. And everyone else I'm looking at as a male, and I'm just thinking, well, this is so odd. This is such an odd room to be in right now. I'm guessing your laugh is saying, yeah, I'm in that meeting every week. Let me tell you about it.
Well,
welcome to our world.
Yes. And Amy and I have definitely had conversations about this. This is where I think an area where we have the most work to do.
Yeah.
You know, as you mentioned, you know, we are seeing more women come into the profession, and definitely even as director of bands, but you're going to, you know, notice those are more of kind of smaller schools and places where there's not maybe as much athletics or athletic bands involved. And there seems to be a pretty substantial obstacle or barrier to this, the connections of getting more women involved in the field of athletic bands. And, yeah, you know, there's so many reasons for that. The one that you mentioned there, but there's lots of others to go along with that. We had a group at the athletic, CBDNA has the athletic band directors conference.
Sure.
In the May or early June, and I think we had the biggest group of women this year ever, right, Amy?
I think I saw a picture of that. I think I saw a picture on Facebook of that.
And I think it was like, you know, 18 or something. It's still, I mean, a low number, but it's the biggest group by far.
And that's one of the reasons we wanted to champion it, you know, and put that out there, because this has been, you know, a pretty consistent and longstanding, you know, athletic band symposium that we have each summer. And just to get us all together for that picture and, you know, and to emulate and model that athletic bands is a path for those coming up and dedicating themselves to music education, conducting, and also having that be a choice on the athletic side of things as well.
Yeah. Yeah, I was just doing I think I made in my notes the only other, not the only other, but one of the other people that came to mind, obviously, was Betsy McCann at Minnesota. And so I was just thinking, the next thing I need to do to put on this is just to make a list. And I'll do that for the podcast and just make a, when I write out any music that we talk about, I'll make a list of and link some people to this. But yeah, I think those are major factors. And I was interested to hear both of your input on that. It seems that's what I imagine. I imagine that. It seems as though while we're championing female composers and conductors and all these things, there's so many other parts of our activity that that deserve more attention. And this seems like it could be certainly although, you know, it's not, I don't know that someone can write a doctoral dissertation on that, but it's certainly an area of an area of investigation as we move forward.
Right. And then going back, Andrea mentioned my colleague, Mary Schneider, at Eastern Michigan University, my previous institution. You know, Mary and I, her as a female director of bands and myself as a female associate director of bands and director of athletic bands, you know, when I was hired, we were the first female director of bands, female associate director of bands in the country ever.
And that was, and you said you were there
2010.
2010.
When I was hired in 2010. And I almost wasn't hired, you know, because I was a woman.
Yeah.
Yeah, definitely.
About that and how far we've come is fantastic.
I don't know. I say you kind of have issues with both. Like there's, you know, the smaller schools in some ways, like I think that good old boy or kind of boys club mentality is even more entrenched because the, as far as like when you're dealing with athletics,
right.
I think in some ways those battles can be a little harder until you, you know, quote unquote, win them over. It's so many fronts with the athletic band situation that you're having to kind of battle with that because, you know, you've got to convince folks that, you know, that you can do the job there in your own school of music. And then you've also got to convince the folks at athletics that you know what you're doing and you're going to, you know, do what you need to do to make sure your program gets what it needs.
Sure. Yeah, absolutely.
Agreed.
Well, thank you both for that. That's really great. And again, it was like I threw you a curveball. It was a non-scripted question.
fine. It's amazing, like Andrea mentioned, you know, how much, because we're in it every day on the composer side as well. And sometimes we forget that, you know, it's not in the forefront of everyone else's mind. You know, like I just did a clinic or I was a guest clinician at Florida State University, you know, last weekend.
Yeah.
And there were several students who came up to me throughout my time there at the festival and then directly afterwards saying they have never played under a woman conductor.
Right.
And a lot of the female students said, I want to do exactly what you're doing. I never knew it was possible. You're emulating a path for myself that I know will be successful for me. And they've kind of claimed that passion for conducting, you know, because I emulated that to them. And I'm so honored, you know, first and foremost, but it's still such a shock that they have never, some students like that have never played under a woman conductor or been
under a woman director of athletic bands.
Right. Yeah. And Andrea, you know very well about the demographics of this area, this part of the country. But I've had similar experiences in that we have a pretty large Hispanic population from different areas, some South America, some from Mexico, with agriculture in this area. And I get the same look or same response from students when I visit band programs in more rural communities and speak Spanish, because to them that is just like it's a non-factor. They've never been, most of them tell me that they've never been to a university because they don't know that anyone there would be able to speak to them. And I'm just like, whoa. All I said was like, hello, nice trumpet. That clarinet reed is moldy. You know what I mean? Like, I didn't even tell you like what a privilege it would be for us to have you join us at Murray State, or like what kind of opportunities for scholarships are. No, I told you like, nice shirt.
No.
Yeah. You know, it's so, yeah, I can't relate specifically, but I certainly can understand some of that.
You totally can. I mean, all the things we talk about as women, you can definitely, you almost cut and paste, if not add more to persons of color in the field.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. I recently just saw, this is a totally off base and I won't even put it in the podcast, but I'll just share with you. I recently saw an episode of Will and Grace where they were joking about who the most oppressed group was. And there was this hilarious argument about the elderly and about different races, and then a woman, and then like an older, it was just this whole thing. And I thought, oh my God, this is my life right now. I'm having this conversation with people about
Welcome to our show.
Yeah. What a trip. I want to jump back to our questions. So, you know, I don't keep you all the way until you have to board your flight for Chicago. We talked a little bit about repertoire. And you mentioned obviously being, you know, as a female conductor, that's for some students, it could be their first time. I had a question on here that said, do you have any female or minority composers in mind that people should be aware of? And we talked about that briefly, but I also listed the idea of or conductors or soloists. Have either of you worked with any conductors or soloists in whether that be with your bands or adjacently in other projects you've had the experience, the opportunity to work on, that you think maybe more people should know about these people?
Oh, conductors or soloists. I haven't so much myself, because again, it's just the positions that I have been in for the past few years, and then moving into this one. My experience here so far, like my first concert, we had, because he's right next door, we had Omar Thomas here.
All right.
And I know that you've just performed, or you're about to, if you didn't just do, of Our New Day Begun. And we did that piece and had him in. He didn't conduct a group, but, you know, was here. And, of course, his star is rising and just rocketing. And so it's not, you know, that name is, for me, it's another one. Like, I don't know how you don't know his name.
Yeah, exactly.
But I'm sure that there are still people that, you know, are coming to hear it. But I haven't. I haven't had that enough opportunity, you know, or haven't had the arena to be able to do much of that with my own group. So I'll kind of cede the floor to Amy on that one.
Sure.
Yeah, similar kind of situation. You know, if we have, you know, different soloists, they'll come from our faculty, but I had the University of Missouri haven't programmed anything with that soloist. Or, you know, concerti, you know, at this time. And of course, you know, for conductors, you know, when I was at Eastern Michigan, you know, we hosted an annual conducting symposium, and we were very fortunate to have Mallory Thompson, you know, out 1 year. And that is an all-inclusive conducting symposium specifically for undergraduate population, because we were so heavily focused in music education and, you know, having her lecture to our undergraduate students in addition to those professionals who are attending the symposium. So we were very fortunate to, you know, collaborate with her, you know, at that time.
Sure. And I know, Andrea, you have a background in working in, you know, speaking of adjacent things here, you have a pretty broad experience in the DCI community as well. Are you seeing a change, I guess, the same sort of attention to change that we're talking about in the wind ensemble community or in concert bands, so to speak, with relation to being more acknowledging more of the presence and the opportunities for women, similar to what we're talking about now?
Definitely. I mean, I think, you know, if you're connected at all to the, you know, you pay attention just a bit, you'll know that there was some massive upheaval prior to the summer's season. And so that, it was a long time coming. And those of us, you know, that have been a part of the community for a long time knew that, you know, kind of wondered how it actually had gone that long without something to the extent of, you know, of what was unearthed coming in. So I'm part of now DCI's committee to kind of work on these issues. And so it's called the In-Step Women of DCI. And definitely trying to empower and connect the women of the, you know, of all aspects of the activity, whether it's marching members, alumni, administration, support staff, instructional staff. And, you know, just there's, it's overwhelming because there was, it's instead of when we're in, I think, the Windband community, it's been kind of more of a, though we've had our sputters, there's been kind of at least a, maybe at least tiny, tiny steps forward for a while. Mm-hmm. This, there was like a, just a massive ripping of a big wound opening up. And so now everybody, the community activity is doing their best to deal with things that should have been dealt with a long time ago.
Certainly.
And so, but for sure, yes, in a really unfortunately hurried and, you know, trying our best to get things updated in the way they should have been, you know, long time ago, to the standards that they should be now. I think there's a huge effort to do that in the community.
Sure.
And in some ways, you might even see some overcorrection.
Got it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Last question. Oh, not last question. Last question, sort of related to that, sort of the, you know, the wonderful viewpoint that you both are able to offer. Amy, I know I was sort of sifting through your bio, and speaking of, you know, experiencing something completely different, you've worked with some in relation with American sponsored overseas secondary band programs in China. Can you talk a little bit about the experience with that, especially and not just especially as a woman, but like what was the acceptance like? How did, you know, what was that experience like, knowing, I mean, I know obviously in the news we see a lot of things are changing, certainly for the better, sort of like Andrea's talking about with relations to cultural relations of China. And I'm not going to speak to those because I'm certainly not a historian. But I just saw that in your bio and thought, wow, what a thing.
Yeah, it was really interesting research for me to tackle at the time. I've grown up being an avid traveler. I mean, I was on a plane to Europe when I was 14 years old, and that really helped open my eyes to just the world and culture out in life, you know, outside of the United States. And I was fortunate in my doctoral program that when my mentor, Dr. John Lynch, he was invited to do a festival in Hong Kong one of my years, he offered for one of the graduate students to come with, just so, again, we can get some experience overseas and be a part of that trip. And so I jumped on that opportunity right away and went over to Hong Kong, and it was set in the international school setting. And I fell in love with that atmosphere and the mission behind the international schools overseas, many of which are, again, American sponsored, or the ones that we went to specifically were American sponsored, wanting to provide that American curriculum in the international setting. And I was able
make connections because of that trip.
Sure.
And just see, really, you know, at the end of the day, you know, kind of musicians are musicians anywhere,
right.
You know, because we're tied to that same mission of creating music, and we do speak that same language. And that was wonderful and so connecting in that sense. And after that, I was fortunate to go on a return trip, but this time to Shanghai rather. And that kind of what started like me looking specifically in the American sponsored international schools in China, because I had been to Hong Kong, I had been to Shanghai, and then in my research I realized, well, of course Beijing, that's, you know, one of the largest. And so I just looked at those top three, compared programs, compared it to what we were doing in the United States, and then comparing that specifically to our, at the time, our standards of what was then MENC, of course now it's NAFME, and just doing an inventory of their programs. You know, are they truly meeting our mission that we have set here in the United States, and how diverse is it over there, you know, for our students, or for the students that they're servicing.
Yeah.
And one of the great things is, you know, they're incredibly, incredibly progressive. You know, there was, you know, far more women conductors over there, and just the diverse makeup of what the students' music they're performing. Of course, culturally different ensembles and that they had over there in that setting versus what we do have here in the United States. You know, they had, you know, gamelan ensemble. They didn't really have a basketball pep band,
right.
You know, over there. And so I really enjoyed that research and
awesome.
And comparing, you know, those different programs.
That's awesome. Just a couple questions to sort of bring our focus back to this idea of repertoire and concert bands. And then question 8 is, how do we work to shift the canon towards repertoire that looks more diverse than it currently does without denying the performance of masterworks? And Andrea, maybe you want to jump on this first. I heard earlier when we were talking about talking about DCI, you had mentioned the idea of maybe even an overcorrection. I'm wondering if you're seeing anything like that or those sorts of trends in the concert band programming where we say, you know what, we have to play all this music. Oh God, my kids graduated from
college. Everybody panic.
Yeah. Yeah. And we're going to have seniors graduate from college in a year or two, and they're never going to have played, you know, Holst or Persichetti, or I guess Holst is less of a problem. I'm thinking about people like Persichetti or the Hindemith Symphony, things like that.
Yeah.
Right.
Well,
you gotta be careful.
Yeah, I definitely am wary of the concert repertoire, and I know it's all with the best of intentions, and
right.
So I totally understand that. But the concerts that are all female composers or all African American composers, you know, that can be a good thing, but if that is enabling you to be able to just check that box and then plan whatever you want with,
right.
You know, mm-hmm. dead white guys for the next 2 years, then that's not necessarily, you know, it's kind of creating it as like a, this like show and not legit enough to be included in the other concert rep. And so again, we, you know, in some ways we're happy to take the advances that we get in whatever way they're presented, but those kind of projects make me a little wary. And so, you know, like here this year, I haven't made an announcement about it or, you know, drawn any attention to it but every concert that I've planned the repertoire for the ensemble this year has either, you know, a female composer or a person of color composer included on it, maybe both, but every one of them. But I'm not trying to get a, you know, a gold star or a cookie for this, but to me, it's like, I want to see what happens if it's just there and a part of, you know, what we're doing rather than looky here.
Right.
And I think it's important for us to to bring them in, bring these composers into the mainstream. You know, and they obviously have to stand the test of time if they're going to be part of the canon. And so I'm not saying like they have to immediately go into that, but I think we've got to bring them, you know, to the mainstream of our repertoire planning to allow to see if that's going to happen. Because, you know, it's a numbers game in some ways. I mean, there's been plenty of bad music written by white guys. And so, it's just the numbers of, you know, there's not as many composers of color or women composers out there. And so we've got to get the numbers. They've got to have the chance to have the bad music out there too.
Right.
But, you know, we've got to, I think, making it more of the mainstream and an accepted part of what we play on a more regular basis so that they have the opportunity to have that music become part of the canon.
Sure.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, just to add to that, you know, don't check the box just to check the box.
Right.
You know, you've got to believe in the piece. It has to be meaningful to you. And it's got to be set in a way that'll be meaningful, you know, and a meaningful experience for your students. And you have to be able to dedicate the time when looking back at what you're programming to say, okay, what is missing? Let me invest time in selecting pieces that I know will fit my curriculum, that I know that I will believe in. And it's the hope that their arts will speak for their art.
Right. Yeah, absolutely. I couldn't agree with you both more. It's interesting listening to music and planning out a season. I think we talked about earlier, like planning blind especially is such a challenge. And as you mentioned, it is to some extent every year for all of us. You know, I'll plan this music for the fall. Hopefully they took their instruments home over the summer, you know, that sort of thing. But I agree. I was really interested in programming music by female composers, but at the same time having conversations with people about that very same thing, like, don't just do it to do it and say, this is going to be the season that you did it, you know. So it's like, well, okay, if I find enough good music for this year, what's on the back burner? What's next? Where do you go from here? You know, don't just, and of course, it's not all going to be great. Not all the music written by people that are living today who are big names, not all their music is great, and that's fine. So,
right.
So,
right.
So we're not going to always get the Hindemith Symphony on the first work, right? I mean, it's not going to be like, oh, you know what? Let me write a piece for the Marine Band and this will be it and it'll be canon. Keep it forever.
Right.
That's great. Sort of to start to wrap this up, we talked at the beginning of the conversation, the beginning of the hour, about what our, you know, predecessors at the in the early 1900s that were conductors then, would they recognize the band today? On the other end of that, what do you imagine our profession looks like in the next, you know, 20, 30 years?
Wow.
I guess when I say profession, I should also just say, like, as college band directors and conductors of repertoire, whether that be inside or outside band, how do you think that may be different in the future?
I hope it's colorful.
Yes.
That's great.
Yeah. I hope that, you know, it's equal numbers of, or especially inclusive to all genders and gender identification, you know, and as well as economically available to any person that wants to be a part of it.
Oh, that's such a great topic. We would be here all day to talk about opportunities, right. You know. I'm looking at the letterhead.
I just wanted to be, diverse, colorful, artistic, inclusive, and a community that is continually committed to that vision of being open and creating great art.
Yeah.
That everyone feels that they can contribute to and that they have a voice within and for.
Yep.
And that we're continuing to push that art form. And that's the great thing about what we do. It is a subjective art form. You know, we have the opportunity to create. We have the opportunity to push. And we have the opportunity to say there's not one correct answer to this. And so it's my hope that we can continue to diversify, continue to color what we do, to continue to have that artistic voice moving forward.
Super.
And I hope I'm alive to see all of this as it transitions and to remember where, you know, for us and Andrea and I's careers, where we started, and just see where we're going.
Yeah.
It's really exciting. And I'm hoping, and we've tilted the sandbox rule. As one of my first mentors, Dale Lanis, would say, let's tilt the sandbox and let's continue to tilt the sandbox so we can have an art form and a community that we're really proud of to be a part.
Yeah. Last question. Tell me about, and I've tried to go through and throw them out a little bit as we converse, but what sort of projects are either one of you working on that you'd like to tell, you like people to be more aware of? I love, Andrew, you talked about at the beginning, some digital monitoring, conducting, all those things got my ear like magnetized to whatever was going to come out of your mouth next. And I know, Amy, you're working on any number of things and you're in your second year of your job. Can you both share any projects that you might be working on that people or the listeners might be interested to go click around on?
On the Andrea, talking about women rising to the podium.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
I'm going to link that
and
in.
Amy's definitely a wonderful help and part of the process. But back at the end of May, started a Facebook group for women band directors.
Sure.
That is now over 2,500 members. And it's just a community of for support, connection, celebration of women band directors. And it's really grown to be bigger than I would have ever thought it was, and was going to be, and you know, the connections that people have made, and looking at hosting our first in-person event at Midwest, and actually folks getting to meet face to face. But it's been a big change in our community, because as women, because there's been so few of us, we have been quite competitive, you know, to get that one spot that might be available for a woman. And
right.
So it's been
other conversation.
Yes. So I think it's been really inspiring to watch, that women, one, getting used to kind of tooting their own horn, because we don't do that very well either. And then also celebrating each other's successes and really lifting each other up and realizing that there's more of us out there than maybe we thought, even though we're spread apart from each other, we still have this opportunity to make connections.
Yeah.
And then, you know, going along with that, there's this just got started, and then we were heard.
Oh, right.
That project. And, you know, of course the, Composers Diversity Project. I mean, there's so many really cool things that are, mm-hmm. out there, you know, right now for resources available and folks trying to improve our profession in that way. I think it's really exciting.
Yeah, it's been really meaningful to watch, especially that Facebook group, Andrea, coming to the forefront. I mean, I just remember going back to initial conversation that we personally had with one another.
Yeah.
You know, about that, starting from even last year. Well, let's put #MeToo on our badges for Midwest, all the way up to this really positive online community that has grown over the course of very few months. And how welcoming. And I remember adding people straight away. As soon as you went live with it, I was adding people left and right from my Facebook friends. And it's truly become a very inspiring community and a very welcoming community, and to see how much we truly have in common. And I can't wait to see everyone in person, you know, whoever's able to go to our first event together at Midwest. And it'll only grow from there.
That's awesome. Yeah, it's so interesting that you, especially at through all the multiple levels, I'm sure it sounds like this is a group open to of any and all teaching levels. And so we just had a festival where we had four clinicians for our middle school festival,
I
and they were all
that.
And they were all women, which
awesome.
I mean, they're all recently retired. Three of them were recently retired in the state of Kentucky. They're master teachers.
And I thought, when after we decided on that, I thought, well, that'll be really cool. And no one said anything. And then we have a festival in the spring for high school band, and we have two female clinicians, and the other two are male. And as soon as we announced that, it was in the same program, people immediately told me, well, I'm so excited to see female clinicians at the high school festival. And I was like, well, there are four on stage right now. Like, what's the deal? And they're like, oh, well, you know, I had a middle school female band director, or I had a middle school music teacher, I had a middle school, all these things. But then no one, you know, the numbers were decreasing as the age group ascended. And I thought, well, I was not, I was surprised to hear people say that at the middle school festival, like, oh, I can't wait for the high school festival. There'll be two female clinicians. I was like, well, there are four right now. What do you mean? But I guess, again, what you're saying, this, you know, difference and opportunity, especially as at different varying levels, how that changes and how that scope narrows in some cases.
It's very, very real.
Yeah.
I mean, it's getting better incrementally, but it's, you know, there, and there's a lot of reasons why. That's a several other podcasts.
Well, this is great. And I can't thank you both enough for your time and for your comments and your thoughts. It was really, really excellent. Yeah, I appreciate both of your time, and I can't say thank you enough.
Well, thank you. I think it's a really great idea.
Thanks. I'm going to stop
the recording,
and then I'll give you a little background real quick.